Running a Shopify store and drowning in shipping chaos? ShipStation can fix this for you. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels with advanced automation, batch processing, and shipping discounts that a single platform just doesn't offer. Like discounts up to 90% off major carriers. See how ShipStation can make shipping for your Shopify store better. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
This is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Bill Raggio and Tom Jossen. They are senior fellows for the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. They and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal, a chronicle and analysis of the vast canvas, the Ummah, from the Mediterranean to the Hindu Kush. These last months, we've concentrated on the tragedy of Afghanistan, and there's more to say of that right now. Recently concluded G20 meeting in Rome, everybody on to Glasgow and concerns about climate change. However, the headlines from Reuters and the body of the text: aid charities have issued a plea to G20 leaders meeting in Rome, including Boris Johnson, to allow funding for humanitarian work into Afghanistan, where more than half the population facing the danger of famine. Some 16 charities backed a joint letter warning that the impacts of drought, conflict, have been compounded by a collapse in the country's banking system after Western powers, including the UK, froze international assets in the wake of the summer's Taliban takeover. To that end, a headline from the Washington Post in these last days: U.S. to provide nearly 144 million more in humanitarian assistance to Afghanistan. The additional funds, reads the Washington Post, will bring the U.S. total U.S. aid in the country and for Afghan refugees in that region to nearly $474 million this year. Quote, the largest amount of assistance from any nation. That from the National Security Council. Gentlemen, we begin with a famine underway in Afghanistan and the non-transparency, the fog of war descending on the whole region with the Taliban takeover. I turn to a testimony by a member of the administration to Congress about what is to be done. This from an editorial in the Wall Street Journal. The young man's name is Colin Kahl. He represents the administration and the challenges of the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan. Tom, I start with you because ISIS and al-Qaeda are both mentioned in this testimony to Congress. The puzzle here is we do not know at this point the strength of the Taliban nor its ability to govern. There's so many people who are now in need, and yet the administration is now concerned with transnational threat. Was this always going to be the story, Tom, despite the remarks at the in the middle of August that the Taliban would settle down and rule with an iron fist? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. You know, it was always going to be the case that there were going to be a transnational dimension to Afghanistan after the U.S. withdrawal. I would point to a couple things in Colin Kahl's remarks that are noteworthy because they're indicative of the longstanding problems that Bill and I have documented when it comes to terrorism analysis. You can see that Colin Kahl says that ISIS in particular would be able to pose a threat against the West, according to U.S. intelligence assessments, sometime within the next 6 months, which is really a blink of an eye if you think about it. It's no time at all. But al-Qaeda will take a year or two to be able to pose a threat to the U.S. or the West from Afghan soil. You know, this shows you just how there's been this imbalance, really, in the terrorism analysis over the last decade and a half even, because al-Qaeda just won the war with the Taliban. I think if you look at the way Bill and I have tracked it over time, you can see that al-Qaeda has a much more robust presence throughout Afghanistan than ISIS does. But ISIS became the shiny object within a lot of the counterterrorism circles and has garnered a disproportionate amount of attention. I think the idea that it would take al-Qaeda that much longer than ISIS to pose a threat to the Western Afghan soil is sort of risible. I don't think it makes much sense at all. The other point is that And so this shows the imbalance sort of in the analysis. This idea that al-Qaeda is further degraded than ISIS is when it comes to these matters. But here's the other part of the problem. you know, how do you do this type of analysis where you're distilling just the Afghanistan component from the global networks that both organizations maintain to this day? Both ISIS and Al-Qaeda maintain cohesive global networks. It's not the case that Al-Qaeda is that Al-Qaeda's presence in Afghanistan is distinct from its presence in other places. It's all part of a global network. Same thing with respect to ISIS. This idea that, basically it's just that you can distill just the Afghan portion of the equation from everything else doesn't make any sense. And I'll give you an example of why. I mean, the last actual coordinated attack on American soil by foreign jihadis was in December 2019. It was the shooting at Naval Air Station Pensacola. This was an Al-Qaeda attack. The handler for the shooter was stationed in Yemen and was communicating with him via encrypted technology. But Al-Qaeda in Yemen is thoroughly integrated into Al-Qaeda globally. In fact, one of the guys who just came out and threatened America again with another attack from Yemeni soil is Ibrahim al-Qosi. He's a veteran of the Afghan jihad and remains loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri and is part of the Al-Qaeda chain of command, according to our analysis. I bring that up because there's this idea that they can distill Al-Qaeda's threat from Afghanistan versus other places around the globe. And I just don't think that's the case. I think that it's all integrated and there are numerous ways they could launch an attack against the West.
Bill, I come to you because in Mr. Call's testimony, he includes some statistics about American citizens still in Afghanistan, how many want to leave, how many have not communicated with State Department about their intentions. And there is mention that the Taliban may or may not be cooperating. It's all fog of war. I understand that. Do you have any clarity about the Taliban and how they are conducting their, what you'd have to say, they're looking over their population? In other words, the census of what they inherited. Do we have an understanding of the Taliban providing assurances to not only the United States, but our allies that citizens still in Afghanistan will be given transport out? Or is that just still left to unclear?
I think it's quite clear. If the American citizens want to leave, and the Taliban wanted them to leave, wanted to help them leave, they'd have left by now. We're over 2 months after the Taliban takeover, and there's still American citizens trapped there. And so I think it's quite clear that, look, these American citizens and other foreign citizens are effectively hostage to the Taliban. The Taliban is preventing them from leaving. They're being used as a bargaining chip to get that billions of dollars that is frozen in U.S. accounts, to get humanitarian aid flowing into the country. The Taliban is quite clever about this. Again, if they wanted to leave, they could pack up, go to an airport and leave. And the fact that this isn't happening tells you everything you need to know. The Taliban, and there's another aspect to this. The Biden administration has been deceiving the American public about the number of American citizens there. Colin Cowell indicated that there are at least an estimated 400 Americans in Afghanistan. If you remember when Kabul fell and the Afghan government collapsed, the Biden administration estimated about 100 American citizens are there. Well over several hundred. I don't know what the exact number. I think around 250 or so American citizens have left Afghanistan since that point. And an estimated 400 are there. So it seems that 100 American citizens in Afghanistan is the new 50 to 100 Al-Qaeda fighters in Afghanistan. That's what the Obama administration estimated for 6 years before the U.S. The estimate of Al-Qaeda's strength in Afghanistan. They maintained this static number for 6 years before the U.S. military conducted a raid and killed over 150 Al-Qaeda fighters in a camp in 2015. So we're seeing this same game of gaming the numbers from American officials. You can't believe anything the American officials are saying about the number of citizens inside of Afghanistan. I mean, when there's 43 American citizens from the state of Connecticut that are trapped in Afghanistan, that's just one of 53 states. You could probably assume that there's more than 100 Americans trapped inside of Afghanistan.
Bill, do we have any reason to believe that I read earlier about $144 million in new aid now flowing to a total of 474? that there's a quid pro quo to any of that money right now? X number of millions are paid to this Taliban office and X number of Americans or colleagues of Americans can leave. Is there an indication of that going on?
I haven't seen any indication that that is what's happening, but I suspect something like this is going on behind the scenes. Or more likely, U.S. officials think that providing this aid to the Taliban, and let's make no mistake, this money's going to the Taliban. The Taliban will be taking a large portion of the cut and will be taking credit for the aid. So we'll be propping up the Taliban regime and providing them cash. But more likely, they believe that providing the money will make the Taliban more amenable to leaving. So it's a bribe without a without any conditions attached to it. And that's the worst type of business you can conduct with a group like the Taliban. We all saw how the Taliban treated negotiations for the U.S. withdrawal. What makes us think that handing them money to help get American citizens out without any real conditions attached to it? And how would it even be enforced? You know, this is just absolute madness, John.
I'm speaking to Bill Raggio and Tom Johnson, senior fellows of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. They keep the Long War Journal with their colleagues, and we're looking at the remains of Afghanistan's tragedy that we can see so far. There's famine, a fog around the whole country. And when we come back, Bill and Tom have commented in these last days about Pakistan and China talking about what is to be done. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batch. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and Tom Johnson and Bill Raggio, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, senior fellows. They keep the Long War Journal, a chronicle, an analysis, and a record of what we're looking at in Afghanistan now that we're outside and intelligence gathering is difficult. We need to use interlocutors such as China and Pakistan. And Tom, I come to you because you and Bill have commented in these last days about an Associated Press story that ran within these last days. In a rare joint appeal, the leaders of Pakistan and China urged the international community to swiftly send humanitarian and economic aid to Afghanistan, where people are facing food and medicine shortages in the shadow of winter. A government statement said Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan and Chinese President Xi Jinping discussed Afghanistan by phone. I'll stop there. Tom, is there any reason to believe that Pakistan is now maintaining to the world that it is threatened by the Taliban? The presumption during all of the conflict of these last years was that Pakistan's apparatus is the Pakistan's strength. Has that in some fashion escaped China to shake hands with the author of the Taliban?
Well, I mean, to start, John, you know, the thing is, it's mighty rich of both the Pakistanis and the Chinese to call for America to support the Taliban's regime and prop up and aid the Taliban's regime in Afghanistan when they were Pakistan was supporting and sponsoring the Taliban's takeover of the country. And the Chinese were at minimum rooting for it against America and American interests and America's partners and allies in the country. So the idea that the U.S. should abide by these calls from the Chinese and Pakistanis now to aid Afghanistan is a bit rich. I mean, if these countries, which played a role in the American defeat and the defeat of Kabul in the war, if they're so concerned about the humanitarian aspects of what's going on in Afghanistan, then let them step up to the plate and provide assistance. China is the world's second richest economy. It certainly has the resources and money to do so. It has its own relationship with the Pakistanis. There's nothing preventing the Chinese from stepping up to the plate and providing humanitarian assistance in Afghanistan now, including to the Taliban. Let them own it. And that's part of the reason why I think, as I argued before the Senate Banking Committee last month, the U.S. doesn't really, you know, one of the things that you hear diplomats and these people in Washington talking about is that America can use aid to have leverage over the Taliban. That's nonsense. I don't think there's any reason to believe the U.S. has had leverage over the Taliban at any point over the last 25 years. And certainly some humanitarian aid now isn't going to do that. It didn't have any leverage over the Pakistanis when the U.S. taxpayers footed the bill for about $35 billion since 2001 in military assistance and military reimbursements to the Pakistani state. And the Pakistanis stood by the Taliban throughout that entire time. So I think the Pakistanis, there is a threat to Pakistan, the Pakistan state. Of course, there is from the Pakistani Taliban in particular and ISIS. But as I've described many times, you know, this is a problem of their own making, because the jihadis sit on a wheel of jihad, is the way I've talked about it, the terrorists do. And the Pakistani state supported the Afghan Taliban throughout the entire war and still maintains those relationships now. And the Afghan Taliban, including the Haqqani network, is deeply in bed with the Pakistani Taliban and Al-Qaeda, which comes back and targets the Pakistani state. So this is a problem of their own making, and let them own it. It's not up to the U.S. now to own this problem, I would say.
We go to Doha, Qatar. The news is that Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi met with Taliban representatives to discuss a, quote, range of issues. Bill, I come to you because Mr. Khalilzad has now resigned. His many months, years of conversation with the Taliban, most recently in Doha, in order to negotiate what we were later told were the conditions for withdrawal of the U.S. troops. Do you expect that Wang Yi will have more success with the Taliban, that Wang Yi is under the impression that the representatives in Doha speak with clarity or can assure that what they promise will happen? Has something changed with the Taliban, Bill?
Yes, John, I think the Chinese are becoming more and more suspicious of their new Taliban friends. There was a report, and I can't remember where it was, about a week or two ago, that the a Uyghur jihadist from the Islamic State conducted a suicide attack at a Shia mosque, and that the Chinese were very concerned. Obviously, the Chinese are suppressing the Uyghurs, and the Chinese had a suspicion that this may have been actually helped or assisted by the Haqqani network, which of course is an integral part of the Taliban. So the Chinese are starting to wonder whether that's true or not. And I think it's unlikely that the Haqqanis would be involved in such an operation like that, because it's delegitimizing the Taliban. But the Chinese believe that they had intelligence that was indicating that there might be a Taliban link to this attack using a Uyghur terrorist. So the Chinese, I think, are reevaluating their ties. They like the fact that the Taliban defeated the United States and drove the U.S. from the region, and that there's no U.S. basing in the region now. They would like access to mineral deposits and trade within Afghanistan. But I think they actually understand that they may be beginning to understand that they may not get these things, that working with the Taliban or having a Taliban led Afghanistan is going to come at a cost for them.
And Bill, that attack, I believe it took place in Herat, the one at the Shia mosque. It might have been it might have been Kunduz. I get them confused.
I think it was Kunduz, John.
Kunduz. Yes. Yes, at the time we cited that it was a Uyghur who was used as a suicide bomber. To say that the Haqqanis were involved in it is quite breathtaking, Bill. It shows that perhaps the Chinese intelligence is not first rate.
You know, so a lot of what we see of the information that comes out of Afghanistan is often, you know, the whisper sort, right? So if the right person says something, a former Afghan, I don't know the origins of that information, but and who knows who the Chinese are talking to. This is the kind of information that could be put out by a former Afghan official to the Chinese in order to sabotage the Taliban. You know, we can only guess. But to me, what's interesting isn't the intelligence, but that the Chinese are actually having the suspicion there might be a measure of truth.
Bill Raja, with better information than state security in Beijing, perhaps, and Tom Jocelyn, both of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. They keep the long word journal. We're going to turn to ISIS. ISIS next, with a report in the Wall Street Journal identifying where ISIS is finding easy recruiting. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Bill Raggio and Tom Jocelyn, senior fellows for the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. They keep the Long War Journal, which is a very careful chronicle and analysis of the vast canvas of the Ummah. All elements are involved now because the victory of the Taliban in Afghanistan have reawakened networks. Those networks are recruiting. Certainly, there's no better recruiting poster than victory over the Americans in Afghanistan. And those videos will be played again and again over the years to recruit, as much as the videos of the attack on New York and Washington have been played over the years, over these last decades. However, we come now to a report in the Wall Street Journal from the distinguished Yaroslav Trofimov, working with his sources in Pakistan, Dateline Kabul. Quote, some former members of Afghanistan's U.S.-trained intelligence service and elite military units, now abandoned by their American patrons and hunted by the Taliban, have enlisted in the only force currently challenging the country's new rulers, the Islamic State. The number of defectors joining the terrorist group is relatively small, but growing, according to Taliban leaders. I'll stop there and come to you, Tom. This is certainly the first chapter of a thriller. The question is, what is to be done about this report from Kabul? Is this meant to be confusing? Is this credible? It reminds me a little of what we're told happened in Iraq, the recruiting of radicals out of the prisons kept who had been arrested by the Americans. This was the story. I don't have clarity on it. And one of them turned out to be al-Baghdadi. Does this make sense to you, Tom?
You know, I think at the margins there may be a story there, but I think you have to keep in mind that, you know, the Taliban and al-Qaeda already brought into their fold a large number of Afghan security forces, because from February 2020 on, the Taliban went to local Afghan commanders and brokered their surrenders across the country. The bigger story here was that it was the Taliban and al-Qaeda that integrated former security forces from the Afghan government into its machinery, into its inner workings as it took over the country. That's a far more prominent story, a far more something that happened far more frequently than the story you're seeing here. This is just sort of a minor case study in that some forces apparently have defected to ISIS, but who knows how true that is. You can see the sourcing starts with Taliban commanders, of course, who have always blamed ISIS on America when a lot of ISIS guys are, in fact, former Taliban guys. So the idea that, you know, this is all part of the Taliban framework for trying to pin ISIS on America and its partners and allies. There are other sources cited there as well, but I'd be very careful with this reporting. I think that overall, I think that Taliban and al-Qaeda integrated far more former members of the Afghan security forces than ISIS ever will.
What caught my attention, Tom, is the disinformation, information, odd report that it's U.S. trained intelligence services and elite military units. Now, I ask myself the old question, who does that benefit? Claiming that the U.S. trained actors who are now seeking to destroy the Taliban. I get confused, Tom. Can you tell who would favor this story? Who would say, yes, that's right? Who gains?
Well, I mean, the Taliban obviously gains from this by portraying these former foes of U.S. backed foes as being the same thing as ISIS. I mean, that's the storyline. They're trying to, you know, the Taliban storyline is that ISIS is the creation of America and its former partners in the region, and not its own doing, when in fact the Taliban inadvertently played a much bigger role in the rise of ISIS than the U.S. did in the area. So, you know, I read this report and I was quite suspicious of it, John. Actually, there's another part of it too, where there's somebody cited in the article compares, you know, this situation to what happened in Iraq when ISIS in Iraq actually brought in former security forces from the Iraqi government into the fold. But again, the analogy there is to the Taliban, not ISIS. The Taliban did that in Afghanistan. The Taliban did that when taking over the country. This, again, it speaks to the same thing Bill and I talk about all the time, where there's this myopia when it comes to ISIS, and it sort of misses the bigger picture here of what's really going on.
Bill, I come to you because you mentioned the Haqqani Network earlier. We need to recapture what we can of the reputation of the Haqqani Network and how it moves in and out. This report about ISIS recruiting from intelligence services trained by the U.S. How does this suit the Haqqani Network and their connections to the al-Qaeda? ISIS and al-Qaeda are presumed to still be at odds. This is a puzzle to me, Bill, because you've been watching very carefully the Haqqani network.
Yeah, John, and I want to, you know, reiterate what Tom said. I mean, there's a fetishization of the Islamic State and a desire to elevate them far, particularly in Afghanistan, far above their actual impact. You know, I believe that one article that was talking said the Taliban had tens of thousands of fighters. They have well over 100,000 fighters. Absolutely. And we just witnessed the takeover of Afghanistan. And that article was trying to equate the Taliban strength with the Islamic State strength. So like Tom, I'm highly skeptical. Articles like this are designed to, in my opinion, to deflect the attention away from the Taliban al-Qaeda threat and to elevate the Islamic State threat, because the Islamic State is the shiny object in the room. There's been, as far as the Haqqani networks, yeah, absolutely. The Taliban al-Qaeda syndicate is at odds with the Islamic State in Afghanistan. They have, as they ever have been, the Islamic State challenges the Taliban rule, Taliban supremacy, and the jihad in Afghanistan. And therefore, and the Islamic State won't accept anything but obedience to its emir. So the Haqqanis have in the past believed or known to have used elements of the Islamic State as cutouts in some heinous terror attacks. And I think this is why the Chinese have suspicions about the Uyghur suicide bomber and connecting it to the Haqqanis and things like that. You know, look, I just saw an article where over 100 Islamic State fighters just surrendered to the Taliban in Nangarhar province. The Taliban is working to either reintegrate elements of the Islamic State, because remember, most of these were former Taliban fighters or members of al-Qaeda, the other jihadist groups that were part of the Taliban sphere. They're working. So the Taliban is working to either reintegrate them back into the ranks, and they'll kill who or attempt to kill those who won't. The Islamic State is trying to pick off from more extreme elements of the Taliban, if that's even possible. But here we are, and other groups saying that the Taliban is a, you know, is a part of the, you know, or is acting like a Western government, or they're willing to compromise. They're weak in their jihad. That's what the Islamic State's angle. So there's a competition going on here. But I think the Taliban al-Qaeda syndicate has the upper hand here. The Haqqanis play a key role in both the Taliban and al-Qaeda. I would argue they're the most powerful faction within the Taliban. And therefore, you know, the Haqqanis are working to reintegrate hard to reintegrate those elements of the Islamic State that could be reintegrated, and they'll kill those who won't.
Tom, your measure of ISIS, quite separate from this report, today in Afghanistan. Heretofore, you and Bill and I have discussed ISIS's one-off attacks in Jalalabad and Kandahar and Kunduz and Herat. Is there any indication from your sources that they're growing in strength, or are they the same marginal players that they've been in September?
I mean, look, John, I would say that ISIS still has a persistent presence. They're still attacking the Taliban and its allies throughout the country in various spots. They're not right now. They're not capable of taking territory from them. We haven't seen any evidence of that. But the broader point here that Bill and I are making is that the U.S. establishment became so obsessed with ISIS. And again, there's a real ISIS threat there. There's a real ISIS problem for sure. But the U.S. establishment became so obsessed with ISIS that it disproportionately focused on ISIS to the exclusion of the Taliban and al-Qaeda as they took over the country. That's the point. Like, it's basically saying that a much smaller threat is actually the bigger threat. That's basically what they did. You know, so you had them, you know, as the Taliban and al-Qaeda were about to overrun Kabul, you had the U.S. military talking about working with the Taliban against ISIS and the ISIS threat coming out of Afghanistan. I mean, this goes to show just how the feckless leadership here in the U.S. establishment, they lost the war to the Taliban and al-Qaeda. And so now they want to put everything on ISIS because they don't want to see the full ramifications of their defeat.
I'm speaking with Tom Jocelyn and Bill Rajo of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. We're dealing with what we know so far about the Taliban's success or not inside Afghanistan. We're going to turn to the region next, because different reports, one from Russia, another about the meeting between China and Tajikistan, suggest that our adversaries are moving for a different future than was possible with the U.S. in Kabul. This is a Eurasian centerpiece, the stands and Afghanistan, that must be solved if the dreams of China to connect with Europe and if the dreams of Russia to dominate Eurasia are to be realized. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Tom Joslin and Bill Raggio, who have been my guide, thanks to the Long War Journal, through these many years, decades of the war in Afghanistan that at one time was seen as secondary to the larger crisis in Iraq. Now Afghanistan is back, dominating headlines not only in the United States, not only in Europe, chiefly to do with the famine and what is to be done, but also dominating the senior leaders of both Russia and Federation and the Chinese Communist Party dominating China. One, for example, Moscow, TASS, in these last days, Russia calls on the neighboring countries of Afghanistan to prevent the military presence of U.S. and NATO forces on their territory. This was stated by Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in a video message to the participants in a ministerial meeting of the neighboring countries of Afghanistan, Iran, China, Pakistan, Russia, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan. Mr. Lavrov said, "Once again, we call on the neighboring countries of Afghanistan to prevent the military presence of U.S. and NATO forces on their territory, which are planning to move there after leaving Afghan soil," says Russia. Tom, I also come with the report that China is now promising financing for Tajikistan, a small part of the stands, not a very populous state compared to Uzbekistan, but nonetheless gravely concerned with a migrant, with refugee flow from the starving Afghanistan into its territory. China will finance the construction of an outpost for a special forces unit. The post will be located in Tajikistan's eastern autonomous province in the mountains. Tom, how do you measure what's going on in the region? A contest between Moscow and Beijing, who makes the bigger promises? A warning that these states should not truck with the U.S. or risk alienating Moscow and Beijing? This is a moving story, Tom.
Yeah, I mean, Tajikistan obviously has the biggest concerns of the stands, or one of the biggest concerns of the stands, Central Asian states, when it comes to foreign jihadis coming from Afghanistan across the border and committing attacks. I think both China and Russia recognize that. You have a consortium of different Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups, and you also have ISIS has recruited Central Asian jihadis as well that they have to worry about. And, you know, I would guess that both China and Russia want to prevent America from having a pretext to do business with Tajikistan for counterterrorism purposes. So I'm sure that's playing a role. But, you know, to our broader point, John, Russia and China were rooting for this Taliban victory in Afghanistan. They enabled it in various ways. You know, let them balance this all out. Let them play this game that they were so eager to tie America's hands in for so many years. America can't pretend that we have some leverage here, some ability to affect a position that makes sense or that can balance out all these countervailing forces. America needs to protect itself and its own interests and look at it purely from that perspective. This idea that the U.S. can, you know, I even heard it at one of the hearings I testified at last month, the idea that the U.S. can work with China to counter counterterrorism threats coming out of Afghanistan. I think that's a very marginal case to be made there. The Chinese have their own interests and are willing to do anything to undermine the U.S. first and foremost. And I don't think that they're all that concerned about anti-American terrorists. They're only worried about Uyghur terrorists doing something in Xinjiang. And that's their own problem set to deal with, because the U.S. certainly can't own what the Chinese Communist Party is doing in Xinjiang.
Bill, I'm checking on the Taliban Al-Qaeda camps that existed over the years that you tracked at Long War Journal. Is there any indication now that the Taliban or the Al-Qaeda kindred are reawakening or expanding those camps? Because those would be a clear threat to the region's security.
This is part of the black hole of intelligence that has been created since the U.S. withdrawal. Our ability to monitor these camps was limited even with the U.S. presence. I'll go back to that 2015 raid on the two massive Al-Qaeda camps in Shorbakh district in Kandahar. The U.S. only learned about these after conducting a raid to kill that killed another senior Al-Qaeda leader at a different location. So we only, in some cases, we learned about these camps only through by accident. This is with the U.S. president in Afghanistan, with the U.S. air assets and working with Afghan intelligence. So we know next to nothing about what's happening here. I see no indications that the Taliban has dismantled any of these camps. I see no reason why these camps wouldn't be expanded now that the U.S. has left. The only thing is the Taliban might be wary of expanding an Al-Qaeda presence. But then again, just the other day, they denied that Al-Qaeda is even in country. So you can't trust the Taliban as far as you could throw them on statements like this. So, I see no indication that there's been an expansion of the camps or that there's been an influx. But Afghanistan, again, it's just a black hole of information right now because of the U.S. withdrawal. This is one of the costs of the U.S. withdrawal. And, you know, Tom and I have been very critical of the U.S. presence in Afghanistan, the way we were fighting the war. But one thing you can say, with the U.S. presence there, we were at least able to have, even if it was tenuous, a grasp on the problem there and the ability to take action once an issue like a major camp arising, you could conduct a raid against it. That those days are long gone, John.
Tom, I go back to the conversation we're told on the phone between the prime minister of Pakistan and the general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, Xi Jinping. Doesn't the Pakistan government have good information because of their own state security services, ISI, is said to be a driver on the Taliban's success, and that would mean that it has good information from the Haqqani network that is Al-Qaeda. I'm puzzled at this pretense that Pakistan and China are threatened when, after all, they, at least Pakistan, is the paymaster of the people who are responsible for the Taliban's success.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, Bill and I arguably were blue in our face that the Pakistani state was effectively in bed with the same jihadist forces that were going to boomerang back against them. You know, it's a classic case of blowback. And, you know, they made the calculation that they were going to remain invested in the jihad in Afghanistan. And as Bill rightfully picked up on this years ago, that the Pakistanis had come up with this idea in their mind that there was the good Taliban, which was seeking to overthrow Kabul and defeat America and Afghanistan, and the bad Taliban was going to come back and attack the Pakistani state. And the Pakistanis had this false dichotomy in their head that they could separate the two in these two different distinctions. And in fact, you can't. As Bill and I have documented many times, the good Taliban is the same thing as the bad Taliban because the Taliban is the Taliban. So the Pakistanis now own this, and this is something they're going to have to deal with. I mean, this is, you know, the U.S. can't pretend that it has any leverage over the Pakistani state, or if they just give them some more money, there'll be some reasonable outcome here. It just doesn't work. The Pakistanis created this problem. They were well informed of what they were doing for the last 20 years. They had every reason to know. They can't pretend that they were ignorant. They knew exactly what they were doing. Now they own the problems that they created.
And finally, Bill, checking on these reports, the UN is appealing to everyone to aid Afghanistan because of the famine. Do we have any information about that money that's already flowed from the U.S. into the Taliban's hands? Is there any monitoring of how it is spent? We just have 30 seconds, Bill.
There isn't, John. This is it's completely opaque. The U.S. taxpayer has, you know, everyone who was eager to leave Afghanistan cited $1 trillion, $2 trillion. Now they're so quick to throw money at the Taliban, hundreds of millions of dollars, and there's no accountability for that. The American public should be quite furious about this, and the administration needs to stop funding the Taliban.
So when we learn that, like North Korea, the generals or the leadership use it for their own purposes, we will not be surprised. Is that correct, Bill?
We will not be surprised one bit, John.
Bill Raggio, Tom Jocelyn, they are senior fellows, Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. They keep the Long War Journal. They also do Generation Jihad podcast. I highly recommend to catch up on where we are now as Afghanistan descends into darkness visible. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and four-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right Rug.